Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Bruce Albert, and John Russell. Later, Anna Mateo will have this week's health report. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The European Union has launched a new border force to control the flow of immigrants entering EU member countries. The new force is called the European Border and Coast Guard Agency. A ceremony marking its creation was recently held at the Capitan Andreevo border crossing on Bulgaria's border with Turkey. Europe has received millions of migrants and refugees from the Middle East and Africa in recent years. This has put pressure on many EU members and led to calls to close off the borders. Dimitris Avramopoulos is the EU's Commissioner for Migration. He praised the new border force. He notes the force came to exist just 9 months after it was first proposed.
The European citizens have demanded, and they rightly do so, a tangible European response. And today, we deliver it collectively.
Permanent employees at the new agency, formerly known as Frontex, will be more than doubled, according to EU officials. At least 1,500 border guards will be ready to quickly deploy to areas experiencing a sharp increase in migrant activity. Currently, EU citizens are permitted to travel freely across borders of 26 countries. But the rising number of refugees and migrants led some nations to reestablish their own border controls. More than 300,000 migrants have arrived in Europe in this year alone, many passing through Turkey. Critics of the EU's new border force say wealthy EU nations are not doing enough to care for their share of migrants and refugees. Gurri Vengulic is Deputy Europe Director for the rights group Amnesty International. She said the wealthiest EU member countries currently host less than 10% of the world's refugees.
That needs to shift, and no border guard is going to make that happen. That's going to require political will and some durable solutions.
Flows of migrants from Turkey have decreased since EU officials struck a deal with Turkey in March. Under that agreement, Turkey promised to return all migrants who try to enter Europe illegally. But Vengulic said this is just a way for Europe to outsource its asylum policy.
They're leaving it up to Turkey to host millions of refugees. They're leaving it up to the very borders of Europe, so mostly Greece and also Italy now, to host refugees. And it means that people are stuck in the most horrendous conditions.
EU officials have said the new border agency will respect human and refugee rights. But they say the force must also be used to help the EU regain control of its borders to prevent another crisis. I'm Brian Lynn.
U.S. government's top education official wants schools to do a better job teaching students whose first language is not English. U.S. Education Secretary John King said the issue is important. That is because one in every 10 U.S. students from grades kindergarten to 12th grade are English learners. Most English learners arrive from a country that speaks another language or have parents from a non-English-speaking country. There has been progress in recent years, King said. He noted Spanish-speaking students are graduating high school and attending college at higher rates than ever before. But in too many places across the country, English learners get less access to quality teachers, less access to advanced coursework, less access to the resources they need to succeed, King said. King said a new federal law called the Every Student Succeeds Act can help. It allows school districts more ways to use federal money to improve programs for English learners. That includes better training for English language teachers. Kelly Gonis is a policy advisor at the Department of Education. She said research shows giving instruction in two languages, English and the student's native language, is better for English learners. Although it takes them a little longer to master English, they do better on tests that measure reading and math skills, Gonis said. So do people who enter dual language programs already proficient in English, Gonis said. To be proficient means able to read and speak a language. Sarah Catherine Moore is director of online learning at the Center for Applied Linguistics in Washington, D.C. She said two recent studies found English learners do better if they attend classes that use both English and the student's native language. But Gonis said such programs are still not offered by a majority of schools teaching English learners. One problem is finding enough qualified teachers. Gonis said some school districts are hiring teachers from Spain and China. They are trying to make up for a shortage of teachers in the United States who can offer instruction in two languages. But such programs are not always easy to set up. In New York City, for example, the city's Department of Education says its students speak a total of 180 different languages. About 60% are Spanish speakers, and another 14% are Chinese speakers. It also has 6,546 students who speak Bengali, 6,501 who speak Arabic, and 3,591 who speak Haitian Creole. Thousands more speak Russian or Punjabi. Gona said that it may be hard to find instructors who can speak all the different languages spoken by students. But she said schools can get educational material in many more languages than just Spanish and Chinese. Terry Richards is in charge of federal programs for the state of Delaware. She welcomes the new federal education law. It will allow state and local education departments to make more decisions about how to teach English learners, she said. Richards said the law permits local school districts to consider local needs in developing English education programs. I'm Bruce Alpert.
A new study suggests that there may be a limit to how long people can live. American researchers found that the longest a human being can live is about 115 years. The researchers are with the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. Their findings were published in the journal Nature. The study was based on mortality and population records from the Human Mortality Database. The database has a collection of records from more than 40 countries dating back to 1900. The researchers found that the average life expectancy has risen greatly since the 19th century. This has resulted partly from developments in modern medicine, including the use of vaccines, antibiotic drugs, and improved treatments for cancer and heart disease. In addition, there have been many improvements in public health and nutrition. In 1900, someone born in the United States could expect to live 47 years. Today, Americans can expect to live an average age of 80. According to the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the Mediterranean nation of Monaco has the highest average life expectancy in the world, 89.5 years. Next are Singapore and Japan, each at 85 years. The oldest documented person to ever live was Jean Calment of France. Calment was 122 years old when she died in 1997. An Italian woman, Emma Morano, is currently recognized as the world's oldest living person. She is 116 years old. Researchers in the new study said their findings suggest that the greatest average human lifespan was reached during the 1990s. They noted that some individuals born in the U.S., France, Japan, and Britain lived to be at least 110 years old between 1968 and 2006. But the number of people living past 110 years is very small and considered not reachable by most of the population. The study found that survival rates have improved since 1900, with some older adults living to age 100 and above. But then many of those individuals died a short time later, regardless of when they were born. The head of the study, Jan Vige, is head of the genetics department at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He said the findings show a decrease in the ability to reduce death rates among older adults. He said this suggests a possible limit to human lifespan. Brandon Milholland was a lead scientist on the study. As he noted, it is possible that someone might live slightly longer, but the odds of anybody in the world surviving to 125 in any given year is less than 1 in 10,000. Jan Vige noted that continued medical developments to improve the quality of life, especially in the developed world, could push average life expectancy beyond 80. But, he said, researchers still do not expect the average human lifespan to ever break 100. I'm Brian Lynn.
Virginia is one of the so-called swing or battleground states in the 2016 presidential election. Voters there could decide whether Republican Donald Trump or Democrat Hillary Clinton becomes president. The town of Leesburg, Virginia, holds many memories of the past. In many places, it looks like the Virginia that voted for many years for Republicans in presidential elections. But Virginia is changing. Democratic candidates for president know that it is no longer a state Republican presidential candidates know they will win. Craig Green is a Clinton supporter. Green is a Democratic activist in Loudoun County. Loudoun County is a part of Northern Virginia that has changed due to the growth of the high-tech industry and a rise in the number of foreign-skilled workers. Green says the changing demographics will help Democrats and hurt Republicans.
I went canvassing this weekend, and pretty much universally it was, oh, that Trump guy, there's no way I could vote for him.
From 1968 to 2004, the county voted for Republican presidential candidates. But in 2008 and 2012, Barack Obama won Virginia with the help of Loudoun County. The U.S. Census Bureau reports that 15% of the county's population is Asian. Green notes many African, Indian, and Chinese families also live in the county. Shriya Mudanar is a software engineer. He is a Democrat and a Clinton supporter. He came to the United States almost 30 years ago. He says the county's growing immigrant population is affecting the politics of Virginia.
They take an oath of citizenship when they become Americans. And that's a very solemn process. It's a very moving process, and we have all gone through that. And that binds us to America very, very strongly into its values. And one of the values is that everybody is really equal.
Even though the state's demographics are changing, Donald Trump is working hard to win in Virginia. Leesburg restaurant owner Brian Crosswhite is a Trump supporter.
He resonates because he's a straight talker. He speaks the truth whether you like it or not. He's going to tell you what he thinks.
More than 150 years ago, Virginia was the site of many battles during the Civil War. Today, it is a different kind of battleground. The state is changing, and an increasingly diverse population is writing a new chapter in America's story.
Sunday's U.S. presidential debate was the most tweeted debate in Twitter's 10-year history, the social network said. Twitter users sent more than 17 million debate-related tweets during the 90-minute debate. The second presidential debate between Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump was held at Washington University in St. Louis. Part of the anticipation surrounding the debate came from recent information about statements by former Secretary of State Clinton and businessman Trump. 2 days before the debate, a video appeared on the internet showing Donald Trump making lewd comments about women. Then, WikiLeaks released parts of Hillary Clinton's speeches to financial companies. The speeches appeared to show her close ties with those companies. The candidates began the debate in a contentious way. They did not shake hands when they appeared in front of the audience. In general, American presidential candidates shake hands before beginning a debate. The two did shake hands after the debate ended. One of the first questions of the debate addressed the video of Trump. The candidate defended his words by saying, "I don't think you understand what was said at all. This was locker room talk. I'm not proud of it." Locker room talk refers to a conversation between men that is usually harsh or sexually offensive in nature. Trump's defense included accusations about Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton. Trump said that Bill Clinton did far worse. He also criticized Clinton for her use of a private email system while she led the State Department. He added that if he were elected, he would instruct a government investigator to look into the issue. This statement became one of the top three most tweeted moments in the debate, according to Twitter. Clinton answered that Trump's accusations were not true. The Federal Bureau of Investigation studied Clinton's email use. FBI Director James Comey said there was no reason to bring charges against her. The candidates discussed several foreign and domestic policy issues, including Syria and the set of health care laws commonly called Obamacare. Both candidates called for creating safe zones in Syria. Safe zones are areas where civilians can be kept safe during war. Trump said he disagreed with his running mate, Governor Mike Pence, about Syria. The two candidates will hold their final debate on October 19th. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Roller coasters are fast and exciting, but passing a painful kidney stone is not. The process is painful and can take a long time. But American researchers have found that a roller coaster ride just might help those suffering from a kidney stone. They say such rides help patients pass the stones with a 70% success rate. The findings come from researchers at Michigan State University. They published their findings in the Journal of the American Osteopathic Association. David Wartinger led the study. He says he became curious after hearing many stories of people who passed kidney stones after going on a fun ride at a theme park in Florida. Patients told him that after riding a roller coaster at Walt Disney World, they were able to pass their kidney stones. One man even said he passed three different stones after going on the ride more than once. To test whether the claims were true, Wartinger used a three-dimensional model of a hollow kidney. Inside the model, he placed three kidney stones, each no larger than 4 millimeters. Then he placed the man-made kidney into a backpack. The researchers put the kidney on Disney's Big Thunder Mountain roller coaster for 20 rides. Wartinger found that where the person sits on the roller coaster can make a big difference. He said in the pilot study, sitting in the last car of the roller coaster showed about a 64% passage rate. Sitting in the first few cars only had a 16% success rate. Researchers decided to expand the study. They rode the same roller coaster with several kidney models. When sitting in the back car, the success rate of passing the stones was 70%. It also mattered where the stones were located in the kidney. The researchers found that stones located in the upper part of the kidney model were passed 100%. Another variable, it depends what kind of roller coaster. When it comes to passing kidney stones, not all roller coasters are equal. The researchers used 174 kidney stones of differing shapes, sizes, and weights to see if each model worked on the same ride and on two other roller coasters. They found that Big Thunder Mountain was the only one that worked. The other two roller coasters both failed the test. Wartinger said the other rides were too fast and too violent. The movement forced the stones against the side of the kidney. He said that the ideal roller coaster is rough and quick, with some twists and turns. How common are kidney stones? About 300,000 people in the United States go to hospital emergency rooms with kidney stones each year. One common treatment for kidney stones, called lithotripsy, breaks up larger stones into smaller ones. But Wartinger said the treatment can leave many smaller stones. To solve this problem, he suggested riding a roller coaster after a treatment when the remnants are still small. Wartinger thinks roller coaster rides could also be used as a preventative measure. He said that a yearly ride on a roller coaster could even prevent stones from developing. You need to heed the warnings before going on a roller coaster, he said. If you have a kidney stone, but are otherwise healthy, and meet the requirements of the ride, patients should try it. He adds that it's definitely a lower-cost alternative to other treatments. And riding a roller coaster is definitely more fun. I'm Ana Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.